Welcome to Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. I'm your host, Skylar Jeremias. When it comes to the U.S. biosimilar industry as a whole, adalimumab is on everyone's mind. 2023 ushered in a new age for these products, and so far, 8 adalimumab biosimilars have entered the market, and companies are looking for any way to stand out from the crowd. Some have chosen to use a dual pricing strategy to both get on formulary and offer steep discounts. Some have chosen to align their prices more with the reference product Humira. Some are leaning on their interchangeability or high concentration labeling in hopes of becoming the new preferred adalimumab option among pharmacy benefit managers, also known as PBMs, and providers. However, whether these new biosimilars, if any of them, will gain significant market share or generate meaningful savings for Americans will remain to be seen. Today, we're joined by Fran Gregory, Vice President of Emerging Therapies at Cardinal Health, to discuss the initial market reaction to adalimumab biosimilars and her predictions for how the rest of the year will play out. Gregory recently published a paper claiming that adalimumab biosimilars will transform the U.S. healthcare industry, and she's been keeping a keen eye on how this is playing out in the real-world setting. She's also well-versed on the European and Canadian experiences with these products and can provide valued insight into how the U.S. health system can champion the use of these products. Welcome, Dr. Gregory. To start us off, how do you feel about the market introduction of adalimumab biosimilars and the prospect for more biosimilars in the immunology, gastroenterology, and rheumatology spaces?
Yes, I absolutely love all of the excitement that we're seeing around biosimilars this summer. We have been anticipating a number of launches in the adalimumab space, which we're seeing now. So Amjevita did come to market a little earlier in January, February. And now we have seen a number of additional launches, which again, I'm extremely excited about. The market has been anticipating this moment. And we're seeing not only the launches come to fruition that we've been waiting for, but some really exciting pricing strategies as well. We're seeing discounts to these biosimilars brand new to market in a very, very deeply discounted strategy in some cases. So I think a lot of us have been kind of curious as to exactly what that might look like when they do come to market, how deep those discounts would be on those low WAC pricing strategies. And they're definitely very pleasantly surprising. Not only the pricing strategies being pleasantly surprising in some cases, not all, but in some, it's also just great to see these products come to market and offer more opportunities for patients to access and to have choices in the medications, as well as providing more opportunities for physicians and prescribers to prescribe a medication that may be cost savings or improve access for a patient.
What advice do you have for clinics and health systems looking to provide more education on biosimilars for patients and healthcare providers? And what is the most important aspect education materials should focus on?
I have been extremely interested in all of the educational information that has become available. You know, biosimilars have been around for a number of years, obviously, but the information that's available today is so much more abundant than what we saw, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. So when I'm thinking about educating providers or patients or pharmacists, other healthcare, workers that interface with patients, it's really important for them to have the right type of information on hand. So for the physicians or prescribers, I think it's really important for them to be able to understand what are all the products. What are the clinical attributes? What type of clinical attributes might make a difference to my patient? What might my patient be more receptive to than another product? So really just understanding all of the products available, the opportunities for patients to maybe have a product that they even like better than the reference product for a number of reasons. Secondly, for pharmacists, it's really important to be able to be very confident in explaining the clinical and the safety benefits that biosimilars offer. So pharmacists will be much more involved in this kind of pharmacy benefit way of biosimilars that we're seeing with Humira and the insulins. So it's really important that pharmacists instill that confidence in their patients, as well as the prescribers, the physicians, the nurses. So it's really healthcare workers that interface with patients all need to have that confidence and that understanding. So it's important to learn and to get resources from reliable places, right? We all can Google things and come up with all kinds of interesting information. However, some of the more reliable websites that I like to refer clinicians to would be the FDA. Obviously, that's always a good reliable source. Go straight to the truth. Center for Biosimilars is a really good resource. Biosimilars Council, Biosimilars Forum, BBCIC, the Biologics and Biosimilar Collective Intelligence Forum, and Pharmacy Times is always publishing great articles as well that are very accurate and clinically sound. So there are a few reliable places, and there are many others. Those are just some of the examples that I like to use. But obviously, you know, I would advise to stay away from forums that are not well known or recognized as, you know, clinically sound to the reference educational material.
In July, 7 adalimumab biosimilars launched in the U.S. Several of these products were launched with 2 WAC prices, one to get on the formulary and one with a significant discount to Humira. How do you think this pricing strategy will impact the potential for lower out-of-pocket costs for patients?
So the actual cost to patients is dependent on a number of factors, as many of us are, if we didn't already know, are certainly learning with these biosimilars. The first, I think, in the pharmacy benefit space is obviously the formulary selections that the payers and PBMs are putting in place in this space. Again, I think we're pleasantly surprised that we're seeing biosimilars being added pretty much upon approval to many large formularies. So I think the first thing that would create a potential cost savings would be that the provider selects a product that's on formulary in a preferred position or in a preferred tier within that formulary. So some products may not be covered at all, and that patient could, you know, have to pay a higher price for a biosimilar if it's not on that PBM's formulary. So the first step is, you know, making sure that the product is a covered product and that it's, you know, preferably in a higher tier position or a better tier position with a lower cost share. That's not always the case, as we all know. Sometimes that cost savings is not passed on to the patient when there is a case of, you know, a flat copay or a standard copay across a tier of drugs, like a specialty tier of drugs. However, there are some types of formularies. This is kind of the second, second piece of information that's critical in determining whether a patient saves money on a biosimilar or not would be if they have a cost share percentage. So a lot of these cost share percentages are based on the list price of the drug. When that is the case, a biosimilar having a low WAC or a lower list price would actually lead to patient savings on that that particular biosimilar. So we are seeing, again, these high WAC and low WAC strategies. So where those low WAC strategies come into play, those patients on those cost share percentages would definitely see some significant savings from that biosimilar. So I feel like there's a few layers, if you will, of things that we need to evaluate to determine whether the patient will actually see the savings from a biosimilar. However, we all know that biosimilar savings is a very big picture type of thing that we want to see across the entire U.S. healthcare system. So whether patients save money today or in the future, we know that bringing biosimilars to market and ensuring a successful biosimilar pipeline and a vast biosimilar pipeline, we will continue to decrease healthcare costs in the biologic space. So I think it's a matter of, you know, today we will see some savings, and we know that we've seen quite a bit of savings already on the patient side, but I think we'll continue to see that grow as biosimilars continue to bring savings to the healthcare system overall.
In the adalimumab space, we're seeing more PBMs come forward with which adalimumab products they are adding to formulary. It seems to be Amjevita, the first to market, and Ciltizo, the only interchangeable option, are the most popular. What can providers and clinics do to encourage PBMs to cover more products?
Yeah, it's interesting. Many of us have hypothesized prior to these products coming to launch which ones would kind of be the selected products for specific payers and PBMs. And the products that are kind of, you know, that we're seeing being covered on a lot of the larger PBM formularies are indeed kind of what we expect. We would want to see a high WAC, you know, from a payer perspective, potentially a higher high WAC, low WAC product. We would want to make sure that the products have all the clinical attributes that Humira has. So I know that, you know, Iramos has every formulation and concentration that the reference product has. So that kind of checks that box. Amjevita kind of checks the first to market box and being, you know, we want to be a market leader and get a biosimilar on formulary first. We've got Amjevita coming to market early, and then Cyltezo, of course, has the only interchangeability designation so far. So I think, you know, if you think about kind of a payer PBM perspective, you want to have all your bases covered, which I think is great because it offers choice to providers and to patients. We're not seeing all biosimilars being covered, but I do think that the ones that are being chosen are kind of the first probably round. I do think that we'll see more covered by more PBMs and more formularies over time. And, you know, PBMs tend to sort of, they won't necessarily stick with the same one forever. We might see some added, some dropped over time. So I don't think that this is, you know, something that's a done deal by any stretch of the imagination. I do think we'll continue to see an evolution there. But I think it's really exciting that we're seeing them being added and we're seeing multiple biosimilars being added to many of the largest formularies in the US. So I think it's really good progress. And I do think that it all again comes down to choice and offering patients and providers options. And that's what's happening.
With so many products and so many differences between them, including administration devices, citrate concentrations, formula concentrations, and interchangeability labels, what do you foresee being the biggest challenge for clinics in the management of multiple adalimumab products?
Unfortunately, choice does lead to a little bit of complexity at times, and that's definitely the case with these adalimumabs. A lot of the things that we're hearing, and I definitely agree with, is the way that we have positioned biosimilars in the US, being that biosimilars all kind of have their own brand names, and some of them are coming to market with unbranded versions. And again, like you mentioned, having high concentration, low concentration, citrate containing, citrate free, high WAC, low WAC, and interchangeability, non-interchangeability. Those are so many different variables just for a prescriber to kind of keep track of. I know I've seen several cheat sheets and kind of, you know, different tools and resources for prescribers to use that can help them kind of identify what would be the best option, the best clinical option for this patient. And then, of course, which one's covered by their payer PBM. So there are a lot of nuances, right? Again, kind of I view this as layers of complexity being introduced by biosimilars, not only by biosimilars. But when you have, you know, 7 to 10 biosimilars for the same reference product, I think you just do add a couple layers of complexity. I think that is nothing that we will not overcome. But I definitely think as we kind of get used to all of these biosimilars, it's knowing which one to prescribe on the prescriber side. And then, you know, for the pharmacies, I think the inventory is going to be a challenge, you know, just the physical space that they have to store a refrigerated product and thinking about one, you know, reference product that I used to have to make sure I had plenty of refrigerator space. Now I have to store 10. Where do I keep those? How do I know which ones are going to be more highly utilized? And really learning how to manage that inventory, I think, is going to be another key component of that. And then finally, you know, the patient education piece, making sure that pharmacists are going to have to learn multiple different injection devices and teaching patients. A lot of times, specialty pharmacies are teaching patients over the phone or via Zoom calls or video calls, learning all of those different devices relatively quickly so that they can ensure that the patients have confidence and comfort in taking those biosimilar medications as well. So definitely a few layers of added complexity, but again, I think the value definitely outweighs any of those challenges, and we'll see kind of a stability reach the market, you know, after this period of learning.
With states having different laws regarding interchangeability, new bills being introduced to Congress to eliminate switching study requirements, and only four biosimilars overall having an interchangeability designation, what is your view on the value of interchangeability?
Interchangeability introduces an additional cost when the manufacturers are researching the medication, doing clinical trials. They're required to go through an additional step. And it's not just a little step, it's an extremely large step involving patients and clinical trials and millions of dollars of additional cost to prove really biosimilarity again, sort of. So it's really kind of an extra step that's extremely costly that is really just, again, proving that your medication is indeed, the same thing or a biosimilar of the reference product. So I think the opinion that this is an extra, maybe unnecessary step is shared by many, and that's why we're seeing these bills being introduced. And I think the bills make sense. They're very tactical. Here's what language we could remove from the 351K FDA approval pathway to kind of just back that out and maybe simplify this process, and not only simplify the process for manufacturers, but simplify the process for physicians, for prescribers, for pharmacists, for the entire healthcare system. Interestingly, for the biosimilar, the one interchangeable biosimilar that we have in the adalimumab space today, it is a higher cost product. So I do believe that these additional clinical trials are unfortunately going to lead to higher costs being passed through to the product at launch. And that's not really what any of us want to see. I love seeing these huge discounts that we're seeing on these new products with these low WAC strategies. And that's what we want to continue to see more of. And if we continue to add cost to the process to get the drug approved, it'll be more difficult for us to bring down those costs long term.
Now, follow-up question. Do you think the interchangeable label will have an impact on adalimumab adoption? Or do you predict that adoption rates will be more like those in the interchangeable insulin space?
It's interesting. That's one of those kind of predict the future questions since we're still in early stages of this launch. However, Cardinal Health publishes a really nice biosimilars annual report. And we did publish this one in 2023, and it did kind of clearly highlight that many providers prefer an interchangeability designation in order to have a comfort level prescribing an adalimumab. So even though we know this is a regulatory step, it is absolutely not a clinical designation. It's not a safety or efficacy designation. It's a regulatory designation only. Providers are being, they're being convinced that this maybe is a differentiator. And we do have some data supporting that, at least in the rheumatology space. So will that impact market share? I think that will be determined in a lot of ways by the selections of the payers and the PBMs and the cost savings that's potentially passed to the patient. However, it's definitely not something that's going to hurt them at this particular point in time. I don't think that it is a bad thing to have interchangeability designation until we figure out as a country what we want to do with that longer term.
Your commentary piece mentioned that greater adoption of adalimumab biosimilars will expand patient access to these products and lower drug costs. What needs to be done to ensure those savings reach patients as well as payers, employers, and health systems?
Absolutely. Whenever I think about patient access and lowering patient costs, it kind of comes back to kind of two words, and it's choice and competition. So by having more choices for a prescriber or physician to choose from in their adalimumab, treatment decision, they're able to make some decisions around which ones are covered by the payer PBM, which ones might have a lower cost share if the physician's armed with that information and knows prescribing the medication will potentially pass on savings to the patient. That's kind of step one, right? And then, of course, the pharmacist has to educate the patient and make sure that they're comfortable with that biosimilar and feel confident in taking that new but the same medication. So while patients aren't always going to see cost savings right now today, by creating choices, it's going to lead to competition, which is going to ultimately lead to lower costs, which will eventually in some way be passed on to the patient, whether it's, a direct copay or coinsurance today, or whether that just leads to lower premiums and lower insurance costs in the future. The success of biosimilars is critical to mitigate the growing costs of biologics in the US. I think we, sometimes as healthcare providers want that savings to be instantaneous, but it will take time. Again, some patients will see that, and we see millions and millions of dollars being saved by patients already from biosimilars. We'll continue to see that. But I do think we need to be patient and look at that big picture and how those savings will be passed on to patients, maybe in different ways than at that point of care at that time. So kind of opening up our mind to that a little bit.
And lastly, do you have any concluding thoughts?
Sure, I am really excited with where biosimilars are today. I know when we quote the cost savings that biosimilars have already brought to the US healthcare system, we're looking anywhere from $40 to $120 billion of savings over the next 5 years for biosimilars to bring to the United States healthcare system. I view this as, I think this is kind of our turning point, right? In the world of biosimilars, and some of us who have been in this world for a long time have been looking forward to something, really big like Humira. It's the largest sales drug in the world. And bringing a biosimilar to market to compete with that and to really see a huge impact to savings, I think it's just a really exciting time. And then, the great news with the neurology biosimilar being approved kind of in the same time frame, really a lot of our, dreams of the value that biosimilars are going to bring to the healthcare system are coming to fruition. So I think this is a really exciting time, and I'm really excited for the future of biosimilars.
Well, Dr. Gregory, thank you for sharing your insights with us. And thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of Not So Different. You can find additional information on everything we discussed in the show notes. And until next time, you can visit us at centerforbiosimilars.com.